This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Peach Blossom Spring, written by Melissa Fu, read by Eugenia Lowe.
Origins. Tell us, they say. Tell us where you're from. He is from walking and walking and walking. He is from shoes filled with holes, blistered toes and callous heels that know the roughness of gravel roads and the relief in straw, in grass. He is from staying each night in a different place, sometimes city, sometimes country. From roads that wrap around mountains and dip through valleys. From waterways shrouded in fog and mist. He is from walking across China. Tell us your memories, they say. He remembers kerosene lamps burning low, the smell of wood smoke, cold stone floors under his bare feet. Urgent voices, the rasping of coins, carts creaking at night. He remembers a sandalwood puzzle picture. One way up, there were 100 monkeys. Turn it over, there were 99. How did that monkey appear and disappear? He is from this mystery. Tell us more, they say, as they nestle by his side. How did you come here? He crossed rivers. He crossed oceans. He carried a watch bought from a sailor, a letter to open doors, a suitcase, a packet of light blue aerograms, a single pair of wool socks. He went towards the call of a beautiful country, a beckoning dream, a promise made of air. Towards wingbeats of birds, kaleidoscopes of seasons he'd never imagined before. And now, they say, their eyes clear and voices playful, tell us a story. To know a story is to stroke the silken surfaces of loss, to feel the weight of beauty in his hands. To know a story is to carry it always, etched in his bones, even if dormant for decades. Tell us, they insist. To tell a story, he realizes, is to plant a seed and let it grow.
Part 1, 1938 to 1941. Chapter 1, Changsha, Hunan Province, China, March 1938. Dao Hongse had three wives. Their names are not important. The first wife had the first son, Dao Zhiwen. This boy was too wild. He grabbed his first son privileges with one hand and cast away his first son duties with the other. He changed his name to Long Wei and swaggered out of the house and into the streets. He gambled and won, then gambled and lost. Long Wei loves tobacco, whiskey, and women. The first wife had two more children. A girl who grew into a sallow, thin woman whom no one wanted to marry, and a son who died at 5 months. With a heart bound by grief and feet bound by the old traditions, the first wife is now little more than a wraith lost in folds of opium smoke. She only ventures out of her chamber to refill her pipe and condemn the rest of the household. Hongse's second wife works hard. Her back is broad and her hands are rough. She lives in fear of the shrieks and howls of the first wife. Hongse doesn't love her, but he depends on her. Yet, the second wife bore only daughters. their names are not important. They married young and produced sons for other families. His third wife was the favourite. Hong Se even loved her. She will be forever beautiful because she died in childbirth, bringing Hong Se his youngest son, Dao Xiaowen. Dao Hongse's business, heavenly like kerosene and antiques, has been passed down from father to son for generations. Kerosene is good business. Everyone needs heat. Everyone needs light. Hong Se's customers are nationalists, communists, merchants, peasants, farmers. One day, Long Wei will inherit the business and its responsibilities. Up a narrow staircase, in a room above the kerosene shop, Dao Hongse also trades gold coins, jade, antique carvings and hand scrolls. Easy to move, hard to trace, all is valuable. He has trained Xiaowen in the art of discerning between that which is of lasting value and that which is of momentary delight. Between his eldest and his youngest sons, Hongse covers all possibilities. Where Long Wei is street smart, Xiaowen is book-wise. If Long Wei offers bluster, Xiaowen articulates with a fine brush. What Long Wei settles by force, Xiaowen negotiates. As the years pass, Long Wei has only daughters, but Xiaowen has a son. Xiaowen's son is called Dao Renshu. Renshu meaning benevolence, kindness, not Renshu meaning to concede, to admit defeat. Dao Hongse makes sure his grandson knows the difference. Renshu is Hongse's only grandchild who is the son of a son. The boy carries the family name. Above all, he must be protected. It is a late afternoon in early spring. The air tingles with freshness, shaking off the last chill of winter and hinting at blossoms to come. Tiny leaves are opening on the trees, and each day the sun offers a bit more light. Inside Dao Hongse's kerosene shop, the wooden floorboards are swept clean. The counter is clear. Dao Hongse can be seen speaking to a young woman who wears a simple dark green tunic. Her hair is pulled back in a bun. Though it is clear he is her superior, both in age and position, there is an air of mutual respect. The relaxed posture suggests familiarity, even affection. He delivers news that illuminates her face. Although she doesn't embrace him, her elation is clear. Then he hands her a small silk bag and says something as she looks inside. She listens carefully, then responds. He considers her answer before replying. They nod in agreement. She offers a half bow and turns to leave the room. A light goes on in the room above the kerosene shop. Soon, the profile of the woman can be seen in the upstairs window. Shui Mei Lin records the new inventory in her ledgers, her slim, quick fingers working the abacus. Lately, many of her father-in-law's customers have been trading gold and jade for kerosene. Everywhere, cash is scarce and prices have been rising. Dao Hongse instructed that these particular jewels are to be put in hock. The cheerful customer who traded them for a week's supply of fuel pleaded with old Dao not to sell them to anyone else, hoping to soon be able to buy back his heirlooms. Both Mei Lin and Hong Se were perturbed by this deal, yet another sign of the encroaching war with the Japanese. But Hong Se accepted the treasures for payment, of course. He is, after all, a businessman. Mei Lin rises to put the valuables away, moving through the room as if by memory. After closing and locking the glass display cabinet, she looks out the window. The sun is setting, her work is done for the day, and she feels hopeful. Dao Hongse has just told her of the Chinese army's triumph at Taizhuang. Both Dao Hongse's sons are expected home soon, given leave after a bloody but victorious rotation. Mei Lin last saw her husband, Dao Xiaowen, and his brother, Long Wei, 9 months ago. After the Lu Guoqiao incident up north, the brothers had left home to join the fight. Mei Lin and her sister-in-law, Xue Wenling, had been proud their husbands were protecting the future of the Republic. The family awaited news from the faraway front line, but weeks passed, then months, and none came. Though disappointing, this was understandable. The post was sporadic, and troops were constantly on the move. Yet, waves from the war began to push into the city of Changsha. At first, it was just a trickle. Hotels and guest houses filled with wealthier people retreating from the turbulent east. Wenling remarked that at least she could see the Shanghai style sooner. Then, more refugees arrived. Shops were busier than ever, as disrupted supply lines along the rivers and railways drove prices up. The streets and markets clamoured with rallies against the Japanese aggressors. But despite these gallant displays of patriotism, the Japanese advance continued. It wasn't long before Shanghai fell, and by December, the Imperial Japanese Army had overtaken Nanjing. With Chiang Kai-shek's nationalist government relocated to nearby Wuhan, a steady stream of evacuees is now pouring into Changsha. Hongse's news of the victory at Taiyuan is most welcome. The resistance was strong. The Japanese were humiliated. This, everyone is certain, will be a turning point. Best of all, Mei Lin can count on one hand the days until she will be able to hold her dear Xiaowen again. Mei Lin's thoughts are interrupted by shrieking and giggling, followed by the sound of footsteps running across the courtyard. They thump up the stairs and down the corridor. Ren Shu and his cousin Li Ling burst into the room. Breathless and laughing, with messy hair, the two demand snacks. Ren Shu is 3 and a half, and Li Ling is 5. Ren Shu's legs, still chubby, struggled to keep up with his adored cousin. Li Ling's face is so full of warmth and cheer that Mei Lin finds it hard not to smile when seeing her. When Ren Shu smiles, his solemn round eyes crinkle into crescents, and the dimple in his left cheek reveals itself. Both children are flushed from racing around the compound. They have barreled through the house, knocking on the doors of the scary Nainai, the ugly Nainai, and the dead Nainai, running away before anyone could catch them. After chasing the cats into corners, up the walls and out into the streets, they teased Yeye's goldfish in the pond by making shadows on the water and tapping the surface with sticks. Now, they dig through Mei Lin's sewing basket, looking for the sweet lotus seeds she hides for them in the folds of cloth. Once the treats are devoured, Li Ling roars at Ren Shu. She chases him around the room, past the display cabinet, until he crouches behind a carved rosewood folding screen. When she holds her arms out, fingers wiggling to tickle him, he runs to the bedroom and hides under the bedclothes, knocking a pile of neatly folded laundry to the floor. A sharp and impatient knock comes at the door. Li Ling dashes under the bed, and Ren Shu pretends to sleep. Mei Lin opens the door to Li Ling's mother, Wenling. Though it is nearing the end of a long day, Wenling's appearance is immaculate. For as long as Mei Lin has known her, Wenling has eschewed traditional dress and insisted on ordering the latest Western fashions. She is always careful that her oval face shows no blemishes, although it may boast the occasional beauty spot, depending on the trends. Today, she wears her hair in glossy finger curls and exudes glamour with her dark mascara, black eyeliner, and scarlet lipstick. Sometimes, Mei Lin is a bit intimidated by her sister-in-law's sophistication. Mei Lin has never bothered with the fashions. In place of powders, her nose is spattered with freckles, and her heart-shaped face suggests a radiant, rougher charm. Shorter than Wenling, she doesn't wear heels to make her any taller, or tiny shoes to make her more feminine. Xiaowen has always said she is beautiful exactly as she is, and Mei Lin believes him. As usual, Wenling is cross. Without bothering to acknowledge Mei Lin, she shouts for Li Ling to come out now, to stop playing. It's time for her bath. Li Ling and Ren Shu stifle their laughter. Wenling storms into the bedroom and stoops to look under the bed. She pulls Li Ling out by the ankle. When Li Ling stands, Wenling fusses about the line of dust on the front of her dress, glaring at Mei Lin. As Wenling drags her daughter downstairs, scolding her, Li Ling looks back and makes faces at Ren Shu. Mei Lin motions for Ren Shu to tidy the mess. He tries his best, but soon tires of wrestling with the bedclothes and wanders back out to the front room to sit by his ma's side. Time to calm down now. You and your cousin are too naughty, she scolds, shaking her head. But there's a lightness in her voice that suggests amusement more than reproach. After Ren Shu's dinner and bath, Mei Lin readies him for bed. Since his birth, Mei Lin's days and heart have been full. She loves Ren Shu, not because his birth raises her place in the family, to the mother of a son of Hong Se, and not just because his eyes and nose remind her of Xiao Wen. She loves him because his laugh sounds like the wind playing temple bells in spring. She loves him because he fills her with a joy she hadn't known existed before he gave her his first smile. Having married late, at 21, there were times she wondered if she would ever be a mother. She sings him to sleep with the song of the fisherman. His eyes flutter closed. Rest smooths his brow. She will do anything for this child. In the quiet darkness of the room, Mei Lin sits for a moment, a long, absent happiness rising through her. Xiao Wen will be home soon. She can almost feel him in the shadows. She closes her eyes and recalls the eve of his departure. They had returned to their rooms after the last family meal to enjoy their final evening alone. 2-year-old Ren Shu was sitting in his father's lap, roaring like a tiger, excited from the novelty of staying up late. Xiao Wen beamed to see his boy's spirit. Look at this boy. He has grown fierce and strong like his ma. Ren Shu squirmed off Xiao Wen's lap and roared again. Xiao Wen scooped Ren Shu back up. You take care of your ma, yes? Ren Shu nodded. I have to go away, but I will return soon. Right now, it's time for this baby tiger to sleep. He squeezed Ren Shu tightly, and the boy's brow momentarily wrinkled. Xiao Wen kissed his son's head. After settling Ren Shu in the back, Mei Lin had come out again to the very room where she sits now. Xiao Wen was at the table, a narrow wooden box in front of him. Mei Lin put her arms around him and kissed his neck as she sat beside him. He handed her the box, indicating she should open it. Inside was a roll of silk brocade, creamy peony blossoms climbing a green lattice against a dark background. Gold threads traced an auspicious cloud pattern along the edges. Mei Lin caught her breath and stared at Xiao Wen in disbelief. A hand scroll. Xiao Wen nodded, encouraging her to examine it more closely. Mei Lin brushed off her hands, lifted it, and loosened the red tassel. Slowly, slowly, she unrolled the silk to reveal the first painted scene. Ancient, silent mountains, a rushing blue-green river, a group of travellers. She leaned forward to examine the delicate strokes, mesmerised by the fine detail of each bird, stone and tree, the distinctions between the travellers' faces. It was astonishing. Finer work than any Mei Lin had ever seen. When did you find this?
Years ago, while scouting for antiques for my father.
And you didn't give it to him?
No, not this one,
he said, his fingertip tracing the swirls of the clouds.
I wanted to save it.
It must be worth a fortune, she murmured.
Mei Lin, it is for our future. When the war is over and I return, we can use it to open our own shop.
What about Heavenly Light Antiques? He shook his head and smiled.
Old Hongso will be just fine with Longwei's help and Wenling's meddling. Let's dream of something else. China is changing. We don't need to follow every old tradition. Imagine a specialty antique shop just for you and me.
Mei Lin threw her arms around her husband, marveling that she had married a man who could envision such a future. Something of their own. They would build something of their own.
Mei Lin, you must promise me two things. Take care of yourself and Renshu, and keep our scrolls safe for our future.
I promise. Side by side, they sat late into the night, taking in the poetry of each of the scrolls' scenes. After they put it away, they lay together in the dark, tracing the curves of arms, legs, faces. They spent the hours before dawn memorizing the shape of each other. Mei Lin sits at the window in the upstairs shop, waiting. Xia Wen's regiment is expected back today. It was nearly 5 years ago that he'd walked into her family's antique shop in the western city of Yichang with a magnificent Tang Santai camel figurine to sell. Despite its age, the green, tan and cream glazes were clear and unchipped. On its back sat three musicians. The details were uncommonly delicate. Mei Lin immediately knew she wanted it for their collection. As they bargained for a fair price, she was delighted to discover that she shared with the young man not just a love of old treasures, but also a passion for the ideals of the new China. Mei Lin's parents, early supporters of the May 4th movement, believed in women's rights and other reforms for the new republic. They had brought up all their children to know the value of education, hard work, and economic independence. Occasionally, though, they despaired that Mei Lin, their youngest, was too independent. She had already scared off many potential matches and refused several others. However, Dao Xiaowen, this new trader from Changsha, kept returning. Sometimes to buy, sometimes to sell, but always seeking out Mei Lin. Haggling over trinkets evolved into heated discussions about replacing the old traditions with the rigours of Mr. Science and Mr. Democracy, and dissections of the finer points of Dr. Sun Yat-sen's three principles. After several months, no one was surprised when Xia Wen and Mei Lin fell in love. To her parents' delight, she agreed to marry him. 2 years her senior by age, but her equal in intellect and outlook. In her new home, Mei Lin quickly settled into Tao Hongse's upstairs antique shop. Hongse marvelled at how easily she learned the location and provenance of every item in the inventory. He was quick to notice the flawless sums in the ledgers were always in her hand. Hongse jests, with fondness, that Mei Lin is, without doubt, the finest treasure Xia Wen has ever found. Whether through business acumen or canny foresight with regard to his daughter-in-law's strong personality, Hongse had given his blessing for Xia Wen and Mei Lin to live in the rooms behind the antique shop. While still in the Dao family compound, Mei Lin and Ren Shu live apart from the rest of the family, separated by the courtyard. In this way, Mei Lin can slip away from a household filled with mothers-in-law, elder sisters, nieces, nephews, and a revolving collection of cousins, uncles, aunts, and other distant relations who continually appear with hopes that Hongse will share his good fortune. Now, Mei Lin's ears prick up as an army jeep turns and heads down the road, slowing as it approaches the compound. She cries out in excitement and runs downstairs to greet it, arriving before any of the others. When the door of the jeep opens, Longwei gets out. He wears his olive-green service uniform with gleaming brass buttons and black leather boots that go up to his knees. A thick, dark brown leather belt cinches his waist, and a smart cap, emblazoned with the Republic's blue sky with a white sun, sits on his head. He grabs his duffel, then straightens his tall frame, holding his head high. He salutes the driver, and the jeep drives off. "But where is..." Longway's normally imperious eyes look mournful. "Xiaowen?" Meilin's voice sounds small and not her own. A strange silence descends. "He was a hero," Longway says at last. "He was a hero at Taiyuan."
"Where is he?"
Longway repeats it once more. "He was a hero." There must be a misunderstanding. Meilin spins around, looking for another jeep. The road is empty. Where is Xiaowen? Both the brothers were expected. Hongse said both. He must be coming soon. "He was a hero at Taiyuan," Longwei says again, in a voice marked with pride, disbelief, and most of all, sorrow.
"Stop saying that! Hero means nothing!"
Her voice rises to a shriek.
"Did he die? Tell me!"
But Longwei only lowers his eyes and shakes his head. She flies at him, hammering her fists against his chest.
"No! No!"
He catches her arms and holds them. She is sobbing, sobbing. She feels her body collapse into his. The coarse weave of his coat is rough against her cheek.
"I don't know," he says quietly. "I didn't see him again."
A cold cough sounds behind them. She can barely lift her head to look up. It is Wenling. Longwei gently steps back from Meilin to embrace his wife. Now, the rest of the household has come out to greet Longwei. Meilin watches their reunions as if they are actors on a stage. Every part of her feels stunned, and the question, "Where is Xiaowen?" echoes in her head, its answer unthinkable. No one knows. Through the rest of the afternoon and into the evening, everything is muffled, numb. Where is Xiaowen? Grateful for Longwei's return, Hongse's household is enveloped in somber celebration. Victory is costly. Many families have no sons returning. At least, they have one. Somehow, Meilin makes it through the day to dinner time. She is grateful for the distraction of routine, helping to bring a multitude of dishes to the table as wives and children start to congregate. She hears Wenling calling to her girls. Wenling has a voice like porcelain. It slides over the ear, leaving the listener aware of their own rough surfaces. As Wenling walks down the corridors, her jade bracelets clink with each step, announcing her approach. When she enters the dining room, stepping over the high threshold, she nods in Meilin's direction without making eye contact and surveys the table, checking the number of place settings, counting the dishes, and bestowing smiles or censure among those gathered. Working in his father's kerosene business, Longwei had spent years travelling the Changjiang between Wuhan and Shanghai, collecting shipments and supervising distributions in towns and cities along the river. It was on one of these journeys that he found Wenling. The daughter of a prominent and rich Nanjing businessman, her elegance and pedigree enchanted Longwei. He courted her with an ambitious, acquisitive passion. They soon married in great ceremony, with hundreds of guests and an elaborate banquet. As her aging mother-in-law has grown more reclusive, Wenling has become the tai-tai in the house, domineering and idle. It suits her. All the women and children are now at the table, except Wenling's own daughters, Li Fen and Li Ling. She calls for them again, impatient. Although Wenling seems all smooth surfaces, cracks show when she speaks to her daughters. Li Fen slinks in the room, eyes lowered, but not apologetic. The girl has all her mother's mannerisms, but not her devastating beauty. Instead, the seven-year-old's face echoes her father's features, the strong nose and heavy brow, that speak authority in a man, but will one day cause people to describe Li Fen as striking. She has broad shoulders and a short back. Her earlobes are too long, and her arms and legs too short to move with Wen Ling's grace. But she already bears the same air of expecting much more than that which has been offered to her. Two steps behind Li Fen is Li Ling, with untidy pigtails and ink spots on her face. She has Wen Ling's delicate build and bones, her smooth skin and clear eyes, but somehow the allure seems washed away, as if the child is too aware of the perpetual disappointment she represents to her father for not being a son, and to her mother for being too dreamy and soft-hearted. Throughout the meal, Wen Ling fawns on her husband, periodically tracing the red insignia with three gold triangles on his lapel. His daughters cling to his sides. Dao Hongshe gives Long Wei a rare and grudging nod of approval. Mei Lin tries to be happy. She is happy for Long Wei. But what about Xiao Wen? When Ren Shu asks for his bar, Mei Lin holds him close and murmurs on the top of his head that his bar is a hero. And maybe his bar will come home with the next group of soldiers. Mei Lin glances up and notices Dao Hongshe listening to her. When their eyes meet, she sees his are filled with worry and fear for his lost son. Mei Lin makes it through the evening, holding her composure. But in the quiet of her rooms that night, after Ren Chu has fallen asleep, she takes out Xiao Wen's scroll and weeps until dawn. The summer passes in a blur of sorrow and disbelief. Xiao Wen doesn't return with the next convoy, or any after. The wives and sisters, intending kindness, pressure Mei Lin to move into the big house, but Mei Lin refuses. She wants to stay where she and Xiao Wen set up their life together. Maybe he will still come home. Hongse, broken by the loss of his youngest son, lets her do as she wishes. The leaves turn to gold and red, and Xiao Wen still doesn't appear. Without him, Changsha no longer feels like home. Mei Lin writes to her family in Yitang, begging them to let her come home and bring Ren Shu with her. Yet, for all their progressive views about new culture, they adhere to the tradition that she is now a member of the Dao family. She and her son must stay. Besides, they plan to close their shop and move to their ancestral compound in the hills above Yitang. Given all the turmoil in the east, it is a necessary precaution. Yuelu Mountain, Hunan Province, China, October 1938. Mei Lin strikes a match. It flares, then fizzles in the damp, drizzly air. She sighs. Maybe we shouldn't be burning paper money for Xiao Wen. What if he isn't really dead? What if all these riches show up for him in the afterlife and he isn't there?
I don't believe any of that.
Long Wei scans the families walking the path up Yuelu Shan, here to revere the tombs of their ancestors and remember the lost. Even with the uncertainties of war, people have still come out for the Double Ninth Festival. Perhaps during these times, it is even more necessary to hold on to celebrations. Long Wei seems to be searching for someone. Mei Lin wonders who. Not his wife and daughters, certainly. Wen Ling was quick to excuse herself when the morning arrived with heavy clouds spitting rain. Suddenly maternal, she pointed out Li Fen's delicate nature and Li Ling's fading cough, claiming the cold air would make them suffer. She said she'd stay home to supervise the Tongyang cakes for later. Besides, Wen Ling sniffed, it wasn't her husband who was probably dead. Their coats rip and flap in the wind. Mei Lin tries again. The matchstick snaps in half without lighting. She drops it on the sodden pile of yellow and brown leaves at her feet. Nearby, Hongse and Ren Shu launch bamboo boats on a small pond. Hongse has promised Ren Shu a gold coin for the one that carries the most stones without sinking. They had spent the morning lining up boats, trying to decide which could balance speed and seaworthiness while maximizing cargo. Children from other families have wandered over to join in, fashioning makeshift boats from twigs and dry leaves. On the other hand, she muses, maybe it's like filling a bank account for the future. If he does arrive in the afterlife, he will find that he is already a rich man. When Longwei doesn't answer, Mei Lin glances over at him. He is monitoring the edges of the cemetery, noting who comes in and out. Since his return from Taiyuan, Longwei hasn't worn a soldier's uniform. He says he has been promoted. Whatever his new role, Longwei is no longer strictly a military man. Most days, he stations himself in Hongsu's kerosene shop. Men come and go. Sometimes they wear the leggings and uniform of the Kuomintang. Sometimes they wear Western suits or traditional scholar's robes. They are not Hongsu's usual customers. They are a rougher sort, hissing names of towns and crossroads. There seems to be a lot more arguing than kerosene selling. From a chair in the corner, Hongsu scowls and mutters about filial piety, but Longwei ignores him. Eventually, he quiets and listens to the harsh, urgent words that pass between Longwei and these men. Longwei calls them his brothers. They are, none of them, his brothers. She studies Longwei's profile now. He could be a younger, more ruthless Hongsu. Both are over 6 feet tall, but Longwei's broader shoulders suggest a dominance, a forcefulness that the old man lacks. He is muscular where his father is lean. A long scar runs down his left forearm. Is it from a fight? She squints to see any traces of Xiaowen in him. No, there is nothing to suggest these two shared a father. As if he can hear her thoughts, Longwei turns to face her, eyes glittering. He bares his tea and nicotine-stained teeth as he takes a cigarette from a packet and holds it in his mouth. When he strikes a match, it catches instantly. He lights his smoke, then flicks out the flame.
My brother was a fool.
Mei Lin is taken aback. Had she spoken aloud? Xiaowen was a good man, she counters. He wouldn't play mahjong and chase singing girls in the tea houses. He wouldn't deal with those thugs of yours who come and go from the shop all day long. She pauses. Longwei still watches the ground, but his jaw has stiffened. Although she is usually cautious, the rustle of activity in the kerosene shop over the past weeks and Longwei's preoccupation today makes her bold. He wouldn't cheat his own father of shipments and gloss the books. Mei Lin expects a reprimand, a denial, or at least some kind of justification. Instead, Longwei drops a cigarette on the ground and crushes the embers underfoot. He inhales deeply, blows out through his teeth, then stares hard at Mei Lin. He steps closer. She holds her ground and stares back.
A good man, he sneers. Good men die or disappear. Haven't you noticed by now?
He is about to continue when Ren Chu runs up, holding the champion bamboo boat in one hand and a new gold coin in the other. Longwei's expression shifts from spiteful to welcoming. He gathers Ren Chu in his arms and lifts him to his chest. The boy squeals, kicking his legs and laughing. Unease swims through Mei Lin's stomach.
Soon the grain will shed its husk and come forth,
Longwei says to the boy as he sets him down. Ren Chu ignores his uncle's words and races back to Hongsu. Longwei turns to address Mei Lin again.
Change is coming, Mei Lin. It's barely been 10 days since Guangzhou fell, and now this defeat in Wuhan. It's been our good fortune to avoid bombing so far, but Changsha is no longer safe.
Longwei grasps her shoulders and looks directly at her, face to face. The strength of his grip is unsettling. His usual smugness is gone. Why didn't he argue back when she challenged him?
Be ready. For anything. Understand?
A peppery tobacco-tinged heat radiates from him. He lifts his head and gazes past her. Whatever he's been looking for, he finally sees it. After giving her shoulders a firm squeeze, he drops his hands and walks away. Maylin swallows. She massages one of her shoulders. A family of three has assembled at a tomb nearby. Two parents and a young girl. They carry willow baskets filled with flowers, incense, and other offerings. The father uses his coat to shelter his family from the wind, and the mother kneels and sets up the shrine. The girl places a wreath of zhuyu twigs on the ground. The red berries are bright spots in the dull day. Together, mother and daughter arrange a stack of oranges and place a small flask of chrysanthemum liquor alongside. A perfect pyramid of devotion. With a fine-tipped brush and a pot of red paint, the mother refreshes the faded inscriptions while the father winks at the girl. Finally, she lights the incense, and all three stand and bow. A thin wisp of smoke rises, then drifts away in the wind. A sudden gust scatters the paper money Maylin holds loosely in her hand. She rushes to gather the soggy scraps, now crumpled and soiled. Changsha, Hunan Province, China, November 1938. Today, everything feels different to Renshu. The voices from the shop downstairs are louder than usual. The door opens and closes every few minutes. A parade of heavy footsteps pounds in and out. He settles into a familiar activity. As his ma sews, Renshu takes apart the three stacked sections of her sewing basket, sifting through the spools of thread, looking for his favourites. Peacock blue, empress crimson, gold like a cup of oolong. He bites his lip in concentration, lays them lengthways, side by side on the wooden floor. Then, with a long slat of wood, he gives them all an equal push. The coloured strands unwind like a wobbly rainbow. Some days, the winner is the fastest. Others, it's the one that rolls the furthest. He winds the thread back up and races other colours, other combinations, looking for the champion. When he tires of the game, he sorts through the carved cinnabar box of jade charms, golden bells, and silver coins that sits by his ma's side. Every so often, she picks up a coin and continues sewing. It seems like she's been doing this for weeks. He likes to examine the jade pendants, a plum, a serpent, a Buddha. He holds them up to the window, one at a time, and watches the sun's late light stream through, revealing white veins in the green stone. His favourite is the three-legged toad with a gold coin in its mouth. The best part is that the coin rotates. Renshu spins it with his index finger, watching its uneven rattle and whir until it slows to a stop, and then he spins it again. When they hear the stairs creak, Maylin's brow creases. She shushes Renshu and takes the treasure from his hands, slips them back into the box, closes the lid, and puts it in the bottom section of her basket. She folds her sewing over the box. Sensing her urgency, Renshu lines up the basket's middle section and presses it down snugly. Maylin rests the last basket, the one with spools, needles, buttons and scissors on top. As she picks up her knitting, she releases a long, careful exhale, and the line of worry across her forehead fades. Renshu fills his hands with buttons to show Uncle, or Yeye, or whoever is coming along the corridor. It is Uncle and two big men. Although Renshu usually jumps into Uncle's arms when he sees him, the men make him shy, so Renshu stays quiet. The men carry a large wooden crate. They have a leathery, smoky smell that Renshu isn't sure about. One of the men has big boots, and the other a long beard and moustache. Uncle and his ma start arguing. Uncle waves at some of the antiques, and the men open the crate and start loading things into it. Lamps, paintings, small sculptures. At first, they peck carelessly. Renshu's ma says some sharp words and reaches behind a counter for a stack of soft cloths. Uncle barks at the men, and they take all the pieces out, one by one, and start over. This time, they use the cloths to wrap each item. Uncle goes over to a pot in the corner that holds many scrolls. He grabs an armful of them and asks Ma something. She's not happy. She scowls and gives him a box of charms, but not the one in her basket. The men have filled the crate with treasures. Now they knock nails in the top to seal it up. Once they've shouldered the crate and left, Ma lets out a big sigh and slides down to the floor with her back against the door. After a few moments, Mei-Lin rises and goes into their bedroom. Renshu hears her moving furniture. She returns, holding a narrow wooden box. She beckons him to sit by her side at a low wooden table that, until moments ago, held dragon lamps and phoenix carvings. She invites him to open the box. Inside is a scroll. Renshu lifts it up. He loosens the tassel. Mei-Lin leans forward to help him lay it flat on the table. When the first scene is fully revealed, she places one hand on his to stop him unrolling it any further. Her other hovers over the columns of characters as she reads aloud. This, she tells him, is a story of travelling scholars. Here, they start with strong legs and bright eyes. They will follow the river and the sun. Below them, the kerosene shop boils with arguments and rough laughter that carries no mirth. Worried words fork the air. The Japanese approach from the north and the south, like a pincer. Renshu prods Mei-Lin. He wants to see more. As he unrolls the next scene, Mei-Lin rolls up the section they have just read. Once more, she stays his hand when the full scene is revealed. Again, she reads the poetry, conducting its music and story. For the rest of the afternoon, they journey through the scroll, scene by scene, discovering details and making up stories. Guiding Renshu, she shows him her favourite parts. Here, the tiger sleeps, and the travellers pass without harm. There, in the crowded market, the cleverest scholar wins a game of chance and wit. On narrow bridges over mountain streams, travellers contemplate the constancy of ever-flowing motion. Renshu, whispers his ma, have you noticed that none of the travellers face backwards? They move forwards, through the landscapes, and never look back. Cigarette smoke and the rattling of kerosene bottles float up from the shop. Talk of bridges, railroads and rivers creeps along the walls. Leave nothing of value behind. Remember, she says, these travelling scholars carry everything they need on their backs. They leave behind anything that weighs them down. Remember, she says, that regret is a heavy burden. And as she puts an arm around Renshu and points at the traveller resting underneath cherry blossoms at the end of his long journey, she whispers, remember that to have an orchard is to honour the generations that came before and will come after. He nods. He will remember. That night, when a hand grips her shoulder and shakes her awake, Mei-Lin is not surprised. Longwei's voice is low, but the urgency is unmistakable. We need to leave. Now, go out the back. She blinks in the night and sees his silhouette disappear through the doorway. Though it is quiet and dark, if she strains, she can hear rustling across the courtyard in the house. Mei-Lin pulls her sewing basket close, unstacks the layers, checks that the box of coins and charms is still at the bottom. From under her bed, she retrieves the two silk jackets, one large, one small, that she has been padding with notes and coins for weeks. The lumpy bundles in her hands offer a cool, soft reassurance. She puts them aside. They will wear them. On the floor is the box containing the scroll. She wraps it in cloth and puts it in her basket. Her heart thuds and tears smart behind her eyes. More sounds of muffled, hurried movement disturb the house. Maylin reassembles her basket. She tugs the handles together. The basket is heavy, but there is nothing in it she wants to leave behind. A cart rolls by. Outside, a few lights still blink in the houses and streets. She stands and watches Renshu, his eyes closed, his breath unhurried and warm. Another cart stops outside and she hears fierce whispers. She waits another 30 seconds in absolute stillness, inhales deeply, and cups her hand around his small shoulder. In the cart, Renshu stretches his legs, pushing against her sewing basket. Just as they've left their street and are approaching the market, an explosion rocks the air. Renshu twists and arches his back to see, but Maylin tightens her grip to block his view. She gives him a wooden puzzle, tells him to count the monkeys. Absorbed in his task, she keeps him facing forward. Heat and brightness light the night. Flames crackle, shouts carry on the wind. Maylin's eyes sting from the smoke, and her heart is racing. When she turns and looks back, she gasps. Hongsa's shop is burning. "What is it, Ma?" Renshu asks, wriggling. Maylin swallows her fear, steadies herself. "Shh, it's okay," she tells him. Han, the servant who pulls the cart, turns down another alleyway. "Where are we going? What about the others?" she asks. "Big fire, man, big fire! To the meeting place," he says, and continues. Alarm bells are clanging. They pass structure after structure blazing in the night. It wasn't only Dao Hongse's shop. The city is a sea of flames. The roads are filling as others flee the blaze. Some in carts, some in wagons filled with families, furniture, pots, sacks of grain. Many people are on foot, balancing shoulder poles with hastily packed and overflowing baskets. And there are some who escaped with only their nightclothes and whatever they could grab. Army jeeps weave through the masses, headed against the flow, towards the burning city. A few motor cars, caught in the snarl, honk their horns and rev their engines. The fire alarm bells clang over the continuing smoke and flames. The cart jostles over the bumpy road, making Maylin's teeth chatter. Han rushes around a corner, and Renshu is flung out of Maylin's arms towards the edge of the seats. "Ma!" he cries out in alarm. Maylin pulls him back onto her lap and leans forward to shield him, covering his ears and eyes. Another explosion, like thunder in her lungs. Cases fall off the back of the cart, but Han doesn't stop. A whoosh of hot wind engulfs them, blowing smoke and cinders into the night. Maylin glances over her shoulder once more. Although the flames make the air shimmer, chills run down her arms. She won't look back again. Chapter 2. Towards the interior. China, November 1938. At the train station, Han tells him to get out and wait for the others. It is only when Han taps her shoulder, then shakes it, that Maylin realizes she has tensed up, her jaw clenched, her hands balled into fists. Despite the waves of heat and flame, Maylin is shivering. Han wraps a blanket around her. Before Maylin can ask any questions, he hurries off. Maylin looks around, stunned. The station is already crowded with other families. She sees an empty alcove and steers Renshu towards it. "Ma, what's happening?" Renshu asks. "We're waiting for everyone else. Here," she says, lifting him onto a wall so he can see over the crowd. "Can you see Uncle or Yeye coming?" She makes her voice calm, bright. He cranes his head back and forth, keeping watch. Every so often, he reports that he doesn't see them yet, then resumes his lookout. When he can't see her face, Maylin drops the smile. A squall of questions flurries through her mind. Did Long Wei know the fire was going to happen? Is this what he was warning her about? Why so many fires? Around her, rumors rustled. The Japanese set Changsha on fire. No, it was the Kuomintang. Anything to stop the enemy from advancing. No, it was the bandits who love chaos for its own sake. It was the Generalissimo's orders. No, he would never betray us like that. Renchu looks down at Mei Lin and shakes his head, tearful. I don't see them, Ma. It's okay. They'll be here soon. She helps him off the wall. Renchu sits on her lap and leans into her, the top of his head just under her chin. Ma, where's my yeye? Don't worry. He's coming. A few minutes later. Ma, why did we have to leave the house? Shh, she murmurs. I want to go home. He climbs out of her lap. Why are there so many people? I'm cold. I want yeye. Ma. He sticks his face right up close to hers. I want to go home. Stop it, she snaps. He is taken aback. Tears spring to his eyes and he starts to wail. Mei Lin curses herself. She didn't mean to sound so angry. She pulls him into her lap and rubs his back, shushing him more gently. Renchu sobs quiet. Where are they? What if they don't come? Should she go back? Back to what? Where are all the other people going? Should she follow? No, she'll wait. If Long Wei told Han to leave them at the train station, he must have a plan. She fingers the hem of her jacket, tracing the embedded coins. What will they do if the others don't come? Fire alarm bells clang over the shouts and commotion. Mei Lin! Long Wei's voice carries above the noise. Long Wei, Wen Ling, and the girls have finally arrived. Climbing out of their cart, Wen Ling looks flustered, and the girls are wide-eyed and unusually quiet. Long Wei starts to unload suitcases. You are safe! You are safe! Mei Lin slides Renchu off her lap and jumps to her feet. Renchu grabs her hand and burrows into her side. She puts her arm around him. The others? Where are they? Mei Lin asks. Long Wei pauses. They aren't here. Han was supposed to get them. Mei Lin shakes her head. He didn't come back. Long Wei looks around. It is as if he registers, for the first time, all the people, the noise, the despair. Han, he... He leaves his sentence unfinished and keeps searching the crowds. They'll be here soon. Long Wei starts waving at someone. He rushes off into the crowd. It must be Han. But no. He is heading towards an officer standing alongside a military jeep. The officer starts speaking and hands him some papers. Long Wei pages through the documents, says something, then gestures towards the city. They confer. They look at the tracks. They scan the crowds. More than once, Long Wei draws himself up tall and nods. He returns, waving the papers. Something in his nature has changed after his exchange with the officer. Train tickets. His voice is sharp. A train is coming soon. We have to go.
But what about the others? Shouldn't we wait? Mei Lin asks.
Long Wei ignores her. He gestures at the luggage and tells his family to repack. A single suitcase each. Leave the rest with Shu, he says, gesturing at his driver. Cowed by the strangeness of the situation and the harshness of Long Wei's tone, Wen Ling and the girls start sorting through their cases, bickering and agonizing over what to keep. Renchu stands near Li Ling and Li Fen, picking up and putting down the things, books, small dolls, wooden combs, silk dresses that they must leave behind.
Did you know about the fire? Mei Lin challenges Long Wei.
I told you to be ready for anything.
What about the rest of the family? Mei Lin persists.
Shu will look for them. My colleague will send them on another train. We cannot wait. We need to go.
Where?
The Japanese are coming down from Wuhan. Some say they are already at Dongting Lake. More enemy troops advance from the south, from Guangzhou. We are being squeezed.
He holds his hand up to show his index finger and thumb coming together.
There is no time. He's curt. We need to leave.
She looks at him in disbelief. But your father, you're leaving.
I'm not leaving him behind. I told you. Shu will look for them.
There is the whistle and screech of the train arriving. Wenling and the girls stand silently, holding one suitcase each. Renshu comes back to Mei Lin's side.
You are leaving them,
Mei Lin insists.
Why are you arguing?
Long Wei shouts. He glances across the throngs of people, then to the train.
My father, he says slowly, looking at Mei Lin, then at Renshu, then back at Mei Lin again. My father would want to know that the family name is safe.
People are gathering possessions and moving towards the platform. Where are we going? Mei Lin asks again.
Chongqing, the new capital. The train will take us to the Changjiang, where we'll take a steamboat west, to the interior. The government is relocating. We'll follow.
Mei Lin looks again at the crowds, hoping to see Hong Se or the rest of the family.
What are you waiting for? Long Wei says. The city is scorched. The shop has burned down. This is our chance. His chance.
He gathers up Renshu with one arm and his suitcase with the other and starts walking away. Sick with disbelief and dismay, Mei Lin grabs her basket and hurries after him. On the crowded train, Renshu sits on Mei Lin's lap. Despite her initial misgivings, Mei Lin can see they were lucky to get tickets. Long Wei has the right friends, the right kind of influence. The train crawls north. At each station, no one gets off and more people squeeze on, their arms laden with tattered suitcases and awkward bundles. Those fleeing the fire are joined by others abandoning their homes and cities to the Japanese. The air in the coach is close and stale with the odours of too many bodies, with camphor and cooking oil. Renshu's face is flushed and blotchy. He must be itchy and sweaty underneath all his clothes. Eventually, he nods off into a fitful, uneven doze. The train overfills, and people climb onto the roof, bracing themselves against the biting November winds. That night, in the darkest hours, the train comes to an abrupt stop, nowhere near a station, jolting people awake.
What is it? Where are we?
Mei Lin tries to shake off her drowsiness. She rouses Renshu.
Wake up, she whispers.
His head rolls away from her and he leans into Wenling, who stiffens and stands. Renshu's body, heavy with sleep, collapses into the warm spot she left behind.
Renshu!
Mei Lin jiggles his arm, tries to lift him.
Renshu, we have to go.
Ma? He blinks. Once Mei Lin finally manages to get Renshu on his feet, she grabs her basket. Still half asleep, Renshu stumbles waywardly along the aisle and Mei Lin helps him off the train. People stream out of the passenger cars and continue to walk north, deserting the silent hulk of the engine. Renshu lags behind. Mei Lin tries to keep the silhouettes of Long Wei, Wenling and the girls in sight. She glances back at the train. Rising to the horizon in the distance, the tracks are parallel lines gleaming in the moonlight. She looks ahead. There is no gleam. The tracks are missing. On this bewildering night, it seems like every time she turns around, something else is torn away. Something else is lost.
What happened to the tracks?
Someone asks, and Mei Lin leans forward, desperate to catch the answer.
Damn Japs took the tracks, a man responds.
No, it was the army, someone else argues. He took them away to slow the enemy advance.
But what about us?
The man asks. The response is unintelligible. Through the night, they walk and walk. When the children are too tired to go any further, they shelter under a grove of trees for a few hours. Worrying about Hong Se and the rest of the family, uncertain of what lies ahead, Mei Lin can't sleep. Renshu shifts uneasily in her arms, looking for comfort. Eventually, he nods off, and Mei Lin dozes lightly, alert to the sounds of other families nearby. With daylight, Malin wakes to find that Longway is not there. Where has he gone? Across a field, she sees a small village. In the dark last night, they didn't realize how close it was. Wenling and the girls huddle together, still asleep. When Malin stirs, Renshu wakes. Malin rubs his cold hands with her own, trying to warm them up.
"Where is Uncle?"
he asks, surveying the groups of people struggling along the road, some walking, some riding in carts or rickshaws. "I'm not sure. He'll be back soon," Malin says. But then he starts in again with his questions.
"Where's my Ye-Ye? Why did we leave him behind? What happened to the train? Why did we sleep outside? Can we go home?"
Malin doesn't know how she'll explain any of this to Renshu, how she'll explain any of this to herself. He is quiet for a few moments. Then,
"Where's my monkey puzzle?"
At last, a question she can answer. Malin finds the puzzle in her basket and gives it to him. By the time Renshu has counted 67 monkeys, she sees Longway heading back across the field. He rides with a farmer in a blue cart pulled by a donkey. Renshu drops the puzzle and runs to meet Longway.
"Uncle!"
His shout wakes Wenling and the girls. In the stark morning light, Malin sees that Wenling's face is smudged with traces of old makeup. Wenling reaches for her suitcase and takes out a small mirror and cosmetics case, wiping away yesterday's grime. Longway explains that the farmer, Hu, and his donkey will help them. In the cart are a few blankets, bamboo mats to cover the ground, and a bag of sweet potatoes and cabbages. They eat, then pile their cases onto Hu's cart. The children take turns riding and walking. So it goes, walking, riding, walking, joining the constant and slow-moving procession of carts, trucks, convoys, and people on foot trying to make it to the Changjiang. At night, they shelter together near the cart or under trees. When they pass through a village, they venture into the markets to bargain for food. With each day that goes by, feet and tempers become more sore. With each night, the hope of reuniting with Hongse or anyone else diminishes. Even if the family did survive the fire, how would they ever find them? It's been a week since they left Changsha. They are not far from the city of Yueyang when a military personnel jeep drives up and an officer gets out to speak with Longway. The two move out of earshot, but Malin watches. Longway's posture is slightly reserved, as if he is sizing up the man and his message. Then, Longway's eyebrows rise and his eyes open wide. She catches the word generalissimo. Longway nods vigorously and gestures towards Malin, Wenling, and the children. The officer glances over and shakes his head. Longway frowns. The officer salutes, gets back into his jeep, and waits. Longway comes over and says he must go south. He is needed at an important conference in Hengyang. They must continue on without him.
"You're leaving us behind?"
Wenling sputters. His eyes flit towards the waiting jeep.
"It's too dangerous for you to come. You and Malin go on into Yueyang and wait. I will send someone who can take you to Yishang. I'll join you there after the conference."
"But what if the city is occupied?"
Malin blurts, saying aloud what they have all been fearing.
"Oh!" Wenling shrieks. "The Japanese bandits will torture and kill us! You're a selfish bastard to leave your wife and children!"
Her voice rises in desperation.
"Take us with you, or stay! We need you!"
Longway draws himself up.
"My country needs me," he says in a measured voice.
Wenling and Longway lock eyes.
"Go,"
Wenling finally says, her voice ice cold. Her hair is unkempt and her face sallow. Over the past few days, she has given up trying to put on makeup in the mornings.
"Go get yourself killed and be a dead and useless hero just like your brother."
She walks away. Lifan follows.
"I have no time for your nonsense, woman," Longway shouts after her.
Brushing aside her outburst, he pulls his suitcase off the cart. He sorts through a few belongings, then speaks to Hu. Renshu and Li Ling have burst into tears, and Mei Lin hurries to comfort them. She settles the kids on a bamboo mat and gives them the buns she had been saving for today's journey. Their faces are tear-stained and dirty. "Eat slowly," she says. "I'm going to speak with Uncle. Whatever happens, I'll keep you safe. I promise." When she approaches Longwei, he turns and looks at her with such intensity that goosebumps rise on her arms. In his hand, he holds a fat envelope of cash.
"Mei Lin, after I leave, Hu is going to take you to what looks like a deserted donkey track. He'll show you a way through the fields and then he'll leave. At dawn, take this shortcut into Yueyang and go to this house.